Welcome everyone, this is All About Windows Phone Insight Podcast 243, recording this 29th of January 2018. I am Steve Litchfield and I've managed to track down Mr. Rafe Blanford. Hi there.
Hello Steve. Yes, Steve has tracked me down after I last managed to appear on the podcast in the first few days of January. Big thank you to Zach for kind of stepping in the last week. It just has been a bit of a busy January for me as at CES and then sort of work interrupting, but there's been some pretty momentous going on in the kind of Windows 10 mobile world. So I know Steve was very keen to get me on the show, track me on. And I like doing this regular podcast, so I'm going to try and be a little bit better about being more regular. That was one of the New Year's resolutions that I managed to break a week into 2018. But let's see how we get on from here on in.
Well, you say momentous news. I mean, that's one of my rants I keep coming back to, Rafe, is that the tech sites around the world, they pluck news out of context and declare it as momentous, usually saying Windows 10 mobile are dead or Windows Phone is dead. But in actual fact, not actually that much has changed, as we shall come to through some of these stories and try and put them in some kind of don't panic context. So the first story I've got here, titled here on the show rundown, I entitled RIP Insiders Program updates to Windows 10 Mobile from now on will be monthly. Basically, the Insiders Program have changed tack. They were, I think, planning one of these feature 2_RS4 branches. In other words, taking some of the kernel of Redstone 4 due to come out in a few months and porting it across and making it part of a build for Windows 10 Mobile for new devices like the Wiley Fox Pro and, of course, the Alcatel devices and so on. I think they've now changed tack, and Brandon LeBlanc of the Insiders team has confirmed they're not planning any more new mobile Insiders builds, you know, taking some of the new kernels, the new code, and somehow compiling it for mobile, which is fair enough, really, because if you think about all the new features they're adding to Windows in terms of timeline and the mixed reality and the inking and all of that stuff, so much of it is aimed at desktop size screens and extra accessories, extra hardware, none of which exists on mobile. So really, there isn't that much point. So what I think will happen is we'll carry on with this feature 2_RS3 branch, and basically all the security and patch updates to the most of our current flagship devices will carry on that branch for the next, whatever it is, 18 months to 2 years. So no new features, but we will get the security updates, which, given the current state of mobile security in 2018, is a darn sight more secure than most of the Android phones out there.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you're right here. For anyone who's been watching Windows 10 Mobile and specifically the Insider program and all the various releases, whether that's Redstone 4 or Redstone 3 or, you know, the creators update, all the naming and terminology, or indeed anyone who's looked at Steve's diagram that explains this all, none of this will be a particular surprise. Maybe the kind of language and the way that Microsoft talked about it was, as you said, I think maybe a bit unexpected, but it doesn't really change much in reality. And I mean, yes, I think we've said before that the way the mainstream tech press writes about this, you'd have thought that Windows 10 Mobile had died 10 times over, which is pretty impressive. I would take a slightly different tack and just say, you know, although this isn't unexpected and it doesn't change much, I think this is symbolically quite important because, you know, as we've kind of expressed in the past, a platform, mobile or otherwise, doesn't die on one day, or at least very unusually that doesn't happen. I guess in the future, as we get towards cloud and everything being so integrated, it's theoretically possible for something to be turned off and fail altogether. You know, for major computing platforms, there's kind of much more of a period over which things get quieter, more things stop working or more things stop being updated. And I think symbolically, it's important when there's kind of this separation of the two branches. Now, actually, when you dig into the technical details, as Steve just alluded to there, there perhaps aren't so many features that are missing that you would gain that if they were still including mobile in kind of the insider build for Redstone 4.
You had a very good question for me before the podcast. Maybe that's a good time now to ask me that same question on air.
Yes, it is. So I think one of the questions around any kind of platform death or dying away is, well, what about applications? Because these days, most of the value comes from applications. And the way development works in most places, on most platforms, is you're developing against a specific version of the platform. And Microsoft is no exception here, in the sense that Windows developers can develop against, you know, the creators update, against Redstone 4, against the anniversary update. And I probably should have done them in the right sequence. But anyway, you kind of take the point. There is effectively a version of the platform which you develop against. By having this separation between mobile and desktop, effectively mobile is orphaned and left behind. And so any developer who is creating applications that rely on features that are in a new version, i.e. ones that are no longer supported by mobile or aren't included, kind of gets left behind, and basically the applications won't work. I kind of wonder how serious that will be. And, you know, there's an easy answer to this, which, you know, of course, any developer is just going to build to the current version. But of course, I don't think that does happen. So I'm kind of curious to get your opinion on this, because a big part of kind of things staying current are, you know, third-party applications continuing to be provided to the platform.
You mean there are third-party applications for Windows Phone, Rafe? I thought there weren't any. No, no. If you go into the store, if you're listening to this, and go into the Windows Store, Microsoft Store on the phone, and find a third-party application, maybe one of your favourites, or just one at random, and then scroll down its entry, and under System Requirements, you'll see, under Recommended or Minimum, OS, it'll say something like Windows 10 version 10.586.0 or higher required. Now, that was the original threshold back from 2.5 years ago. Goodness me. I'm actually looking under the entry for VLC, a popular media player. There are quite a few third-party apps in the Microsoft Store which now give 14.393, I think it was, the anniversary update. And then there are just a few now starting to come in that say you must have the Creators Update, which came in spring 2017. And that's the baseline that the APIs that the third-party developer has compiled and targeted in the store. Now, of course, we've had full Creators Update since then. Yet another new branch, which is run by most of the phones running, but by most of the people listening to this podcast, I suspect. I would estimate, Rafe, that in about a year's time, developers will be starting to target whatever's after full Creators Update, i.e. Redstone 4, whatever that ends up being called. So sometime around the start of 2019, I think we're going to start to see some of the more heavyweight Windows 10 applications start to fall off any kind of compatibility with Windows 10 Mobile. Or maybe they'll freeze the current version for Windows 10 Mobile and then carry on updating the version for the desktop and HoloLens and whatever we might have after that. But by then we might have a shiny new device, and all of this discussion might be somewhat moot, Rafe, because we'll be chasing the next big thing. But that's the short answer is there's a lag of about 18 months between APIs coming out and new SDK versions and developers getting coding, and between that version then becoming the one they choose as their baseline and leaving older phones behind. I haven't spotted one single application yet which has got even close to being dropped for any of my phones on any of the versions of Windows 10 Mobile. I think we're about at least a year away, I'd say.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that's absolutely spot on. The things that would change that is obviously if there was some really popular feature for developers and they're, you know, you could potentially look through the list and look at some of the navigation related stuff and go, okay, that's going to be a big deal. But the simple reality of this is developers want to make their apps available in as many places as possible.
Yeah.
I would say, sadly, that probably doesn't mean much for mobile, given the numbers we're talking about. But there will be plenty of Windows 10 devices out there that don't necessarily get updated to the latest version, you know, particularly if people don't have the automatic updates turned on, or they're in a lockdown environment for whatever reason. And so developers quite naturally will have a tendency to be conservative in the SDK that they build against.
Yeah,
I think as time goes by, obviously that changes. I would maybe be a little bit more pessimistic than Steve, but I think in the short term, it's really not going to make any difference at all. And I think even when you do start to get the applications taking advantage of effectively what are these unsupported features, for the really big ones, they probably will take care to support older versions.
Yeah.
And I suspect it will be kind of niche applications that probably wouldn't have been released anyway on Windows 10 Mobile. So I think actually maybe the 12-month timeline is fair enough. Nonetheless, I think actually that is one of the things that kind of sets not exactly a timeline, but it certainly is another milestone to look out for, because we've talked in the past about Microsoft having 18 months of support updates. I think actually having applications that support the platform were almost as important. And obviously, this probably has an implication for some of Microsoft's own applications as well, because as time goes by, more and more of them will be built against the kind of the new version of the SDK. So that means you won't be getting the updates. Now, they won't stop working because you'll still be able to get the kind of older versions of the applications. And so it's not a big concern. But I suspect there is, you know, I hinted at earlier, platforms sort of dying for a couple of reasons. And actually, when it's cloud, you know, you can take so many blocks out of the Jenga tower, and at some point it will sort of fall over and become virtually unusable. And I would suggest that as more and more things go by, and we're seeing obviously services disappear as well. I mean, I think we'll probably talk about maps later in this podcast. We talked about kind of music recognition, I think a few podcasts ago. More and more things this will apply to. So I'm not trying to be unduly pessimistic. I think it's great to be realistic about these things. But yes, sort of the short-term doom and gloom that I've seen associated with this, I think really is quite misleading. But, you know, we promised to look into the details. And actually, I think, you know, whether it's 12 or 18 months, there is something that people should be well aware of, particularly if they're sort of, you know, thinking about buying a new Windows device at this point in time.
Yeah, in fact, it's actually not 18 months, it's 28 months. Right? It's a common typo across the web. But 28 months is the standard Microsoft support term for any branch of Windows 10 on any device. That's so just over 2 years. And I've been looking through the store, Rafe, while you're talking. You mentioned some of the Microsoft in-house applications. I've just picked Word at random. Word's minimum requirement is Windows 10 version 10.2.4.0, which is the initial version that shipped with the Lumia 950 back in the end of 2015. If I got that right.
Yeah, wow. So, right. There you go. So schooled by Steve.
So, and I've tried a few others, including Tweetium, you know, the major Twitter client, and that's still back on the 10.5.8.6. And remember, this is a branch of Windows 10 that's three branches ago, and that's the baseline now. So again, I think the 18 months is a good figure in terms of a baseline moving up through the supported tiers, if you like, for third-party apps. And I'd say in about a year's time, we're going to start seeing more applications saying you need the full creators update, for example, as the baseline, which again won't be a problem for people, you know, with 950s and Alcatels and so forth, because they're on it. And if you look at the second story in the show rundown, Rafe, which I've entitled, he said, frantically scrolling, Windows 10 Mobile, the January 2018 status for all compatible phones. And I do like my charts, and I hope the readers and listeners like my charts too. I'm basically just taking the more popular modern Lumias and other Windows devices and color coding exactly which version, which branch of Windows 10 they should be on. So hopefully if you use this chart in yellow, green and orange as your reference for where your device should be, and if it's not, they get it on there. And also that will help you in the months and years to come, as if applications do start saying, okay, well, we now only support branch 1703 or branch 1709, you can then sort of place them on the chart, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. And as you'll see, if you look at the chart or the table here, the more recent devices obviously have very good support up something. And I guess it's fair to say there's a few more white spaces appearing and a few more caveats over which versions you can get. But honestly, that tends to apply to devices like something like the 430 or the 535, which I would be surprised if it's a kind of a mainstream device with someone actively installing lots of applications. I think as we've kind of remarked on before, the one that's sort of a little bit curious about this is the 930 in the icon, which I could understand if people were still using that as a device, because it's, you know, a pretty decent device. But even so, we are talking about something that's getting on for basically, well, it'll be 4 years old this year. And then obviously the Lumia 640, you can get it onto the most recent version, but it's one of the sort of caveated ones. Yeah. And I know there's a lot of people out there with that as a device as well. But yes, you're right, actually. I think, as I sort of said before, it isn't one point where suddenly third-party apps stop. It's not even stop working. It's going to new ones stop being released, or you stop seeing updates to your favorite one. There is going to be a period of time where it gradually trails off. And actually, you could probably say quite safely that for the first 12 months, you won't see any evidence of that. You'll see the first evidence of that between 12 and 18 months. Yeah. And if we said 18 months was the point at which, you'll probably notice that, and it will become an inconvenience or a problem, in the sense that there's a good chance that one of your favorite apps, or there's an app you know fancy downloading. I actually think the bigger problem will not be kind of existing apps and updates, because people can probably live without that, But I think we may see, and this is definitely at the 18-month point, a decrease in the number of UWP apps being released with a kind of a mobile version, if you will. It's way too early to say what that will actually look like, because I think for the time being, it's very easy for developers to continue kind of doing a release for mobile. And actually, a lot of the UWP apps are built by developers who actively seek to support Windows 10 mobile, either because they have the device themselves or they kind of believe in the philosophy of UWP and they're making it available on as many devices or classes of devices as possible. But some of the kind of professional apps, I mean, if you're a business, it's harder making a decision to support, you know, a category of devices that runs into, you know, the few millions. You know, that would apply just as much to mobile devices, something like the Xbox or, you know, some of the holographic computing or the headsets that we're starting to see. But I think there'll be a very healthy hobbyist scene. I guess it's more, and actually even now we're seeing a lot of the big companies make announcements about no longer continuing to invest or stopping support for their Windows device. That doesn't always mean the app disappears, but that's something to watch out for. But actually, as I say, the big point here is there isn't, we can't draw a line and say on this date it will no longer be like that. All we can say is there will get to a point where it becomes probably more of a bothersome consideration than it might otherwise be.
Yeah, although, of course, most universal Windows platform applications are exactly the same applications. The developer doesn't actually have to code for mobile at all. They simply adapt themselves according to the display resolution and aspect ratio. Now, there are games particularly, and there are some professional applications which do kind of skew into a different UI, a different layout, a different format for desktop and mobile. But the vast majority of Raven, certainly the apps that I've been championing, Wallpaper Studio 10, which is one of the ones I put up and reviewed today as we record this, is a great example. And it just adapts itself. The application is coded well enough and the operating system and the APIs are coded well enough that the exact same application can just behave itself, whatever device, whichever chipset, whichever screen size it finds itself on. So I don't think we need to worry too much in terms of UWPs.
No, and honestly, it's a testament to the UWP system that's possible at all. And actually, I suspect even now, there are quite a few apps that are released without their developers really checking very thoroughly how well they work on Windows 10 mobile, judging by some of the quality of things we see. Because actually, one of the things that's probably not always very obvious is for all the apps that Steve chooses to feature, there are quite a few that basically don't make the cut. And I suspect we may see a few more of those. I mean, I guess that's, you know, a slightly less significant version of a feature not being supported in the future. Nonetheless, I mean, we managed to talk around this topic for, you know, something like 20 minutes. But it's an interesting one. But yeah, Steve was right. It's the don't panic mentality should still dominate your thinking.
Yeah, and there are applications, of course, as you say, which are developers code for Windows 10 desktop and maybe Xbox as well and HoloLens and all of that, and they don't actually check it on Windows 10 mobile at all. So I then come along and think, oh, okay, a new UWP app. I install it on a Windows phone and hey presto, it basically works, which the developer hadn't considered at all. Now, usually, quite often, there is something like a dialogue doesn't fit on the screen properly or a control is off the side and you can't access it without rotating the phone. And it's a bit messy on mobile because literally the developer didn't consider mobile at all. Having said that, the application still runs without any testing whatsoever by the developer, which I still think is a good kind of a cool testimony. Anyway, moving on swiftly in the show notes. And related, really, to that chart I just showed you just now, Rafe, with all the different Windows 10 mobile phones, all the different Windows phones, 8.1 devices that were upgraded to Windows 10 mobile, and the current branches of Windows 10 they're on. And I wrote a feature called Why Missing Out on Fall Creators Update is Not a Big Deal After All. Now, there's an awful lot of people with the Lumia 930, the Icon, the 1520, as you mentioned. It's a really popular phone, and it's still a great device. It feels great in the hand still. Lovely screen, etc., etc. And those devices are basically limited, unless you hack them, but they're basically limited to, if you went via the Insiders program, to the Creators Update. And I don't think it's a big deal. If you bring up the story, Rafe, I've actually broken down the change log from the anniversary update, which was autumn 2016, to the Creators Update, which is spring 2017. And it's a really long change list, something that's 15, 20 different bullet points, and there's a major, major update of Windows 10. So really, really worth getting. And all these devices can get that. Now, the creators update, the full creators update, as you might gather, judging from the rather lame name that Microsoft gave it, they weren't sure what to do with it either. There's a very, very small change log, just a few bug fixes and patches under the hood. And as we've said many times before, all the different security patches and the genuine kernel bug fixes, they get applied to all the different branches that are supported, right back as far as anniversary updates. So every month we have the patch updates, and every month there is an update for every single branch going back to the anniversary update. So what I'm saying is, if you've got a Lumia 930 or 830 or 730 or 1520 or Icon, okay, you're stuck on Creators Update, but that doesn't mean you should panic. You've got 99.99% the same stuff as I've got on my Alcatel Idol or Rayfast and his Lumia 950.
Yeah, and I think this is just one where completers get upset that they haven't got the latest version. And honestly, as you say, it's not a big deal. I mean, I think it's also worth remembering that Microsoft in the past always had this kind of sense of a cadence of updates, one of which was a big one and it would be followed by a smaller one. And obviously the bigger one in this case was kind of going from AU to CU, and then the creators update to the kind of full creators update was a minor one. I mean, I think in one sense that was almost exacerbated by the fact that the focus for full creator update moved away from generic stuff and from anything that might be construed as mobile specific. And, you know, honestly, that's reflecting the decline in Windows 10 mobile in general and Microsoft's decision to put investment elsewhere. But it was also the fact that, you know, actually just there was a different focus. And, you know, you spoke about inking support and things like that, Steve. Yeah. You know, it was almost like a more focused around the vision that Microsoft had, where it was having success on the transformer type devices, on the touchscreen PCs, and, you know, whether they're laptop or the kind of touring ones, and, you know, the Surface line in particular has been pushing that. And so, as you say, kind of what you're missing out on is pretty minimal. And at this point in time, I actually think, you know, people have had their phones for a while. In most cases, they aren't buying new hardware. So what they're most interested in probably is the security updates. I mean, we've talked about kind of security through obscurity on Windows 10 Mobile, but people still like the reassurance that bugs are being closed off. And we've had Wi-Fi earlier this year, and obviously then we have things like Meltdown more recently, and the kind of the Intel has been getting a lot of press for that, but it does actually apply to the ARM processor and Qualcomm as well. And actually that was something that was one of the updates came through, was addressing some of those. I think in that instance it was Spectre rather than Meltdown.
Yes, it was.
But, you know, Microsoft will be addressing all of those through that mechanism. And that was the 28 months that Steve made reference to earlier in the podcast. And, you know, if you had to choose, obviously, kind of goes without saying, those are the more important updates. And so I think it's fair to say now, you cannot expect to see any big feature updates on your Windows 10 mobile device. You may see some great updates come through the UWP apps, but you are going to continue to see things be nice and secure, and Microsoft will continue pushing that. And actually, one of the things that's really interesting, just in passing, Microsoft has obviously clearly thought about this quite carefully and has architected their system such that it can push through the security patches and those updates, you know, regardless of the base platform version. And I think that probably speaks for how well things have been separated within, you know, the platform layer and some of the architecture that's going on there. And, you know, I don't have enough of an understanding to sort of talk about that really fluently, but it's quite clear that Microsoft can sort of go, yes, we're going to apply this security update, and we've constructed in such a way that we can easily apply it to all versions. And it's such a contrast from Microsoft of old. But because it's something fairly silent and fairly boring, they don't really receive much credit for it. And, you know, you do see other platforms, you know, suffering from these kind of security updates or things not going right, whether that's on the desktop or other mobile operating systems. Android has a, you know, pretty bad reputation in that sense, although perhaps it's a little unfair given the way it's spread across so many manufacturers and so many devices. It's kind of inherently the way it's put together, the way that ecosystem that exists kind of makes it more vulnerable. So I don't think that's something that can necessarily be laid at Google's door, because actually, if you're fortunate to be on a Pixel device or one of the ones where the manufacturer is a bit more security conscious, they do push out very regular security updates, indeed, you know, for the aforementioned kind of processor bugs that have come out recently, and the Wi-Fi ones I talked about as well. And, you know, Apple also does a pretty good job. But then, you know, in the same way that Microsoft has pretty heavy control over its ecosystem and devices, so do they. But no one's immune from them. But the good news is that you will continue to get them if you are using a Windows 10 mobile device. And, you know, judging on the evidence so far, you probably get them as quickly, if not more quickly, than you would if you were on another smartphone.
Yeah, yeah. And I did actually do a story on Meltdown and Spectre about a month ago when all this hoo-ha kicked off, Rafe, and Microsoft issued its patches in very, very short order, mainly for Meltdown, which is off for Intel on the PC. But the Spectre bugs do apply to the ARM processors. It should be noted, and I did a chart in that story as well, that not every Windows 10 mobile phone has an affected processor, only about half of them. And it should also be noted, of course, that the Spectre bug is actually bugs. There's actually two different bugs, and they're both pretty hard to leverage. And you really have to get your malicious app on that a particular ARM powered device in order to do any damage and get any data. And of course, how do you get applications onto a Windows 10 mobile device? They're through the Microsoft Store, which has pretty darn tight Q&A. And also the very fact that Windows 10 mobile now counts as a quote obscure OS in the sense that it as a target for malicious authors trying to make money, really, you know, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the huge wild west that is Android and the possible rewards there. So I think that Spectre, despite the fact that some of our phones have processors which are quote vulnerable to this rather obscure vulnerability, there is 0.000% chance that any of you will ever be affected by it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm sure many of our listeners will have read round Meltdown and Spectre, and in some ways kind of the area to be most concerned is if you're a company that's got lots of cloud servers, because actually that's where the vulnerability could be a real threat, especially with the kind of data that you have on there. Personal computers, well, I guess that's a fair enough thing as well. But actually the kind of engineering that would be required to specifically target you and get a specific bit of data out seems to be fairly obscure to me. Now, I certainly don't wish to underplay it, because actually it is a big deal. And actually the way Intel and others have addressed this has, I think, left some people a bit open-mouthed with surprise. But I think some of this has been overblown a little bit with regard to mobile devices, because there is so much more of a sandbox around the platform and around the way that apps get onto the devices. And, you know, whenever you're dealing with this kind of thing, it's about a risk profile. And obviously that risk is about both the ease of that exploiting that vulnerability and, of course, then the value that comes from exploiting it. And obviously on an individual device, I would suggest that that's kind of there's a lower risk profile than, as I was sort of suggesting, on some of those big enterprise servers. But nonetheless, you know, you are protected, as Steve said.
I think I'm going to entitle this episode the Don't Panic episode, it seems to fit. Now, here's a topic, Rafe, which you are probably the expert on, and certainly not myself. But I was investigating PWAs, Progressive Web Applications, which people have pointed out the app gap in areas of, for example, niche shopping applications and banking apps, all those sort of things, you know, these store apps and banking apps. And although you can go via the website, which quite often are responsive, and I can log into my online banking and I can order things in shopping sites in Edge in their responsive web applications, that PWAs seem to me to be the next stage on beyond responsive applications, with more of the code, more of the processing, more of the semi-permanent storage of resources being handled by the web browser and this, you know, PWA support. And the point of my article, although several people shot me down in flames saying it's not a complete implementation of PWAs, and that's probably very true, it doesn't have full service workers, etc. But if you look down my article, Rafe, there are some quite good examples I've given, not least the mobile.twitter.com, which is a full PWA, which just works just as well as a local application, really, very fluidly and slickly, and almost no waiting. The Financial Times, app.ft.com, a really great PWA. As long as you've got a Financial Times membership or whatever they call it, you can browse away as if you've got a native Financial Times application on your phone, which is effectively what PWAs are. They are semi-native applications. They just happen to be leveraging the web browser. And as I commented to Zach on last week's podcast, the only shame really is that Edge has this, you know, pretty decent basic PWA support for all these modern web applications being written, and yet you still have to put up with the URL bar at the bottom of the browser screen. And that still kind of rankles, but that's really the only fly in the ointment while I was trying out these examples.
Yeah, it's interesting because PWA has been one of those hot topics, but really I think it's just a continuation of the kind of debate that's sort of been in mobile as long as I can remember. It's kind of web versus apps. And we kind of hinted at earlier that apps, you know, are able to have new features as new versions of the platform come out. But actually, so are the web apps. As the browsers get more sophisticated, there's more integration into the platform. You know, a good example of that that's now absolutely commonplace and no one would bat an eyelid at is the use of location and also the kind of the use of video. And it's now possible to do kind of augmented reality and even to a certain extent virtual reality within the browser. Now, PWAs have obviously been targeted at, I would say, a certain type of app, and it tends to be the ones that are based around either kind of content or around a regularly repeating service. And actually, shopping is probably the best example of that. And they make for some great, great apps. And actually, it's about using the right tool for the job. For me, the kind of the big thing is the ability to work offline, the support for push notifications, and there's sort of more things being added all the time. It kind of is the evolved version of PhoneGap in some ways, and some of those hybrid applications as they used to be talked about. And they sort of seem to get rid of some of the downsides of those apps, even if they are all running in the browser. That's a gross simplification. But the other thing I would say is it feels like all websites will evolve towards being progressive web apps, or it will at least will use parts of the technology that are involved in PWAs. And the reason for that is because they will offer up a better user experience. And, you know, obviously you've probably all seen sites using push notifications and some of these features that you may not even realize they're using what are essentially the building blocks of PWA, because they just improve performance. Or, as I say, you know, they've got slightly better offline functionality. Now, the kind of interesting thing, I mean, and it does tend to be quite a vigorous debate whenever you talk about native versus web, and PWAs are kind of the latest thing, and you get people who are very, very pro them and people who are very, very anti them. And I tend to be much more middle ground about using it when it makes sense. And actually, kind of shopping sites makes a lot of sense for me. Things that are effectively mini applications, and Twitch is probably a good example. Big content, so magazines, newspapers, yep, all makes perfect sense to me. But as soon as you start doing something a little bit more complex or that's a bit deeper integrated into the phone, that's where you tend to have problems.
Yeah.
I think the big issue actually with PWAs, and kind of it's hinted at in the comment thread, Edge certainly doesn't provide perfect support for them. You do get good support in things like Chrome and also to a certain extent some of the other kind of less popular browsers. But Safari and iOS still doesn't provide great support for progressive web apps. You know, there's some support for some of the features, and it's the thing that's always hurt kind of hybrid and web-based applications is you're fundamentally limited to support that your browser that you're sitting in provides. And yeah, actually Edge is somewhere between kind of Google and Apple in this sense. And so, you know, a lot of them will work, and you've identified things like the Financial Times and Twitter. But actually, we talked earlier about having to build to the kind of lowest common denominator. And in the case of apps on Windows 10 Mobile, that kind of works to, you know, smartphone advantage. On progressive web apps, you kind of have to develop to, you know, whatever is the lowest common denominator in terms of the audience you want to support. So that would mean, you know, if you want to support both Android, iOS, and say Edge, then you basically need to build to what iOS can support, and everything else will work. And if you want to do a bit more, okay, you have to make it Chrome only. And of course, that then means you end up with two versions of the website and the progressive web app, all that implies. But I do agree that it's something, it's a technology. Well, I would still say it's relatively immature, and most of that is around, yeah, honestly, the support on iOS. It's really interesting. And when you get a good progressive web app, and especially if you're using it on Android, it can be very effective indeed. And actually, for most people, I would be willing to say I suspect they'd have difficulty telling the difference. Now, obviously, the browser bar is a bit of a giveaway on Edge, but if you ignore that, a lot of them feel quite like the UWP applications, because of course the design language, the use, for example, of burger menus, particularly aligned left, seems to be something that's increasingly common across both apps and browsers. Personally, it's not something I'm a massive fan of as a design pattern. And actually, probably the Twitter UWP app is the best example of this. If you don't know what you're looking at, you could probably reasonably assume it's kind of a light version of the full Twitter app. And similarly, if you look at things like Flipkart, which is another kind of retail PW app, particularly big in India, honestly, you know, they've done a great job integrating all of that. And then some of the simpler games as well, you know, for those kind of simple games, I would argue it's difficult to tell the difference. Of course, it's noticeable that all of those, I'm kind of using the word simple or content-based, and that's where PWAs are strongest. But as a technology, really interesting. And actually, if you're building an app and if you're, you know, doing a mobile strategy and sort of making a decision, my personal view is the way things are going to go is that all websites will integrate elements of PWA technology as a matter of course, because that will give the best possible experience on mobile web in particular. And mobile web is now kind of the dominant user. If you look at any stats, you know, it's mostly over 50%. For a lot of websites, it will be 70% plus. And so, of course, you should kind of optimize for that. I think in most cases, you probably also will want to look at having a native app as well, and indeed supporting other channels, you know, whether that's kind of an audio interface with an Alexa skill or some kind of immersive experience through something like HoloLens or any of the emerging technology that's going to come out for augmented reality in the next few years. But, you know, baseline, do a website, make sure it takes advantage of PWA features to give the best possible experience, and then do a native app. And it's noticeable that you get people switching back and forth on the side. And the Financial Times, I think, is a good example. You know, they do have a great PW app, but they've also talked about the fact they're going to look at native apps again. And Facebook went through something similar. You've had some of the big e-commerce sites switching back and forth. But for my advice, for what it's worth, it would be if you can afford to do it, it actually makes sense to essentially have both. And for Windows 10 mobile users, that can only be a good thing. Because you get support of both. The kind of the doom and gloom version of this is presumably at some point kind of Edge on Windows 10 mobile may not cut it, as you know, having support for both PWA features. As I say, it's kind of where that baseline support is. But while Apple is sort of showing no inclination to support PWAs in a meaningful way, then actually probably ironically that's quite good news for Windows and Edge users, simply because it means that kind of common denominator is relatively low. And by the way, Apple won't do it because for its whole approach is to have more done locally, and that's really about native apps, where of course Google, being a web first company, obviously loves the idea of PWAs, and you know, they do make a lot of sense where, you know, there's ubiquitous connectivity. And because, of course, they have all kinds of advantages in that PWAs update automatically. You can guarantee that all your users are effectively on the latest version. You know, there's no install barrier to get through and all of those kind of things. So it's a topic, actually, I'd love to talk about a bit more. So we might come back to it in a future podcast.
I think Apple's just sulking because the PWAs seem to be a Microsoft and Google collaboration project and nothing to do with them. Anyway. It's very noticeable that FT.com, for example, is the site you'd immediately go to an Edge on, say, your Windows 10 mobile device, and that works very well. It's a responsive website. The PWA app is at app.ft.com and looks almost identical, except that it's slicker and faster. And, of course, if there was a native UWP app, it would look identical again, but even faster. So it seems to me that there are all these different tiers, and I guess, as you say, the baseline is where it's important for every single website or service. They have to work out what's the baseline they can present to people in a simple and easy to follow way. And I suspect for a while we'll have the responsive website being the default, and absolutely, there'll be a big button saying, "Do you want to try our new PWA app here? You, by the way, you need Chrome or Edge, whatever." And if you've got an Android phone or an iOS phone or even a Windows phone, then here are our links to the various app stores. So yes, I know there are multiple entry points to services, but at the end of the day, I think PWAs might just come in to fill some of the app gap, at least that we've been seeing in Windows 10 Mobile, and especially in terms of, you know, banking and shopping. To be honest, on that shopping site I linked to it as my example there, it really could have been a native application. It just runs so slickly, and the way the panes of graphics and the toolbars just slide up and down the screen, it's very slick indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I got asked the other day, you know, try and explain to me why PWA apps are good. And I said, actually, what it comes down to, and, you know, you would kind of express this, Steve, is it's where you kind of do the heavy lifting, if you like. Yeah. And effectively what PWAs do is, you know, all the stuff that gets repeated over and over again on every web page, you store that locally. What native apps do is do even more of that locally, obviously. And actually then the investment required to do that, it varies as well. And so it, to me, as I say, it's just a progression of the evolution of web stroke hybrid apps that we're seeing. Yeah. I think the thing that people and the kind of the biggest advocates of PWA tend to forget is the native apps tend to move faster. They'll always get the kind of the latest things to play with, the kind of the new toys, the new design language first, and web tends to lag a bit behind. And more to the point, web is sort of spread over a much broader kind of base of devices, and so that lowest common denominator is always lower. But nonetheless, yeah, it's a great example. And actually, it's interesting, you mentioned FT, their PWA being on app.ft.com. It kind of reminds me of the days where we always used to have separate mobile sites, and to a certain extent, you still sometimes see that. But increasingly now, you know, you'll have a single URL and you'll be served up whatever is most relevant to you. And I've no doubt we'll see more of that. You know, we will see a version that is kind of, if you like, base web, then there's PWA, and then, as you say, kind of links to encourage you to get the app, or indeed deep links that drop you straight in as appropriate. But actually doing the work to have the framework that supports that is actually much harder than you might imagine, because, of course, you need to have all three bits aligned properly and everything set up, and absolute confidence that you are directing people to the right place, because the very worst thing, of course, if it breaks for them for some reason. But anyone who's kind of experienced sort of doing a Google search and then having the native app open and it already being there for you, you know, particularly in the e-commerce thing where, you know, you can then do the one click order and have everything go through, maybe on a fingerprint or a face ID, it's terrific. And of course, PWA can get you part of the way there in that experience. And it's, you know, the age old debate on web versus app is basically comes down to, are people willing to install my app? And, you know, there's plenty of evidence on both sides. So I do wonder whether, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done just to make it easy, because honestly, most people don't care. They just want it to work. Where I think PWAs have a real advantage.
We've just got a couple of minutes left in the podcast. I wanted just one small element of slight doom and gloom, or at least paranoia on my part. And that's to do with Windows 10 Maps. And I'm not just talking about Windows 10 mobile maps here either. Of course, the Maps is the UWP app. It applies to Windows 10 on the desktop and Xbox and so on. It also applies in this case to, you know, Bing Maps. If you go to Bing Maps on the wider internet, on any device under the sun, and you'll find that all the maps are out of date by, well over a year, which I was quite disappointed by, Rafe. Now, the theory, and in our comments, our very well-researched commenters, and it's a good theory, is that Microsoft, when they set up Bing Maps and they had the whole licensing deal with HERE, who used to be Nokia Maps, I guess, before that, and there was a whole licensing deal, and the theory is that those maps were only licensed for updates till the end of 2016, which seems to be about when the maps froze and no new roads after that were added across any of these different Microsoft Bing Maps stroke Maps properties. So that's the theory, that they've basically, someone's either forgotten to relicense it, or someone's forgotten to grab the updates, or someone's in the process of renegotiating a new license with another mapping provider. But either way, it just, for the literally 600, 700 million people across the world who are using Windows 10 with the maps built in, and let's say, you know, another few 100 million or so using Bing Maps on the web, they're all seeing maps that are over a year out of date. And that just seems crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those ones where you hope that someone's not being incompetent, but you kind of sometimes wonder. I mean, it looks like from all the data that kind of the last bit of data that Microsoft Maps got was 2016, which is why we end up talking about, it being at least 12 months, and that probably in reality means 18 months out of date. There's no reason why that should happen, because of course here have continued to update their information. Yeah. As you can see, if you go and look at their website directly, or if you've got the latest update in a car. So I suspect this is a case of there's probably been a change to the licensing agreement, and it just isn't a priority for Microsoft in the same way that it used to be. And it's, I guess that's understandable, in that clearly maps are a central part of the app ecosystem on a phone. You know, it's basically one of the most used apps after the browser, I would imagine, for a lot of people, and maybe messaging as well. But its value is directly related to how recent the data is on it, and is it up to date? And people, you know, we saw all the hoo-ha around Apple Maps and that not having the kind of data to match Google Maps, and what happened then, how irritated people got. And so the danger is the same thing happens for Microsoft. But of course, if you look at maps on a tablet or on a desktop PC, is it that important? Probably not. Made even worse, of course, by the fact it's very easy to just go to maps.google.com and get, you know, dead up to date and arguably a better point of information database, particularly in markets like the US, where of course Microsoft has a real focus. So it's just disappointing to me, because this is something I think that would be relatively easy to fix, because as alluded to in the comments, it's certainly in the here data, and Steve identified a specific roundabout that hadn't been updated. It's just really telling that the traffic data has been updated, but the underlying map data hasn't. I mean, it's kind of terrible, really, in a way. And actually, a lot of the commenters talk about, you know, similar experiences and saying that, yes, Microsoft hasn't done the data. We don't know what the exact answer is. It feels that the likely answer here is that they haven't done an update of the license and the data, and it's not flowing through in some reasons. And kind of the irony is probably if you've got an old Windows phone running an old version of Here Maps, probably you may be able to get a bit more of an update, which is just, you know, absolutely crazy. But it's also a nice lesson in the way that kind of apps and the, you know, the structure that makes them up is often quite separate to the data that powers them. And, you know, Steve and I may talk about a time when smartphones, you downloaded and installed 4 gigabytes of maps onto your, probably in your MMS card in those days, and how wonderful that was. But, you know, the modern smartphone, these modern devices, so closely tied into the cloud, and the data that comes from it, you're going, great, everything's up to date. But it's only up to date if the licenses sitting underneath all of that are up to date. And so really disappointing. Typical of Microsoft, they have been running some of the services down. Honestly, it's probably not a focus for them. And I mentioned the kind of music recognition earlier. There's been some chat around Cortana recently as well. Obviously, they retired the kind of the music services as well. It does feel like Maps is heading the same way, Steve.
But surely it's only a matter of a few hundred million, at most probably only $10-20 million, to chuck it here to say, OK, we want to license your maps for another couple of years.
I would have thought so, but I guess someone's doing the equation somewhere to see what the value is. And I would have thought, you know, from an enterprise point of view, you know, having a very reliable maps platform is kind of pretty much a must if you want to be taken seriously. Maybe we'll see an announcement about this in due course, but it always struck me that kind of the value of the geo database, and what I mean by that is all the kind of, it's not just the map, but also the various layers that sit on top of that, are incredibly valuable, and here recognize that. And there was a lot of chat around why Microsoft wasn't willing to cough up for what was Navtech, then became Here, from Nokia. And I think Nokia probably quite rightly was asking a lot of money for it, and Microsoft didn't see the value. Obviously, it's since gone off to the car consortium. But I only see this increasing in value, because one of the kind of mega trends of the next couple of, well, maybe next decade, next couple of decades, is there will be an ever bigger merge between the digital world and the internet and the web as we know it and the physical world. I think you'll see things all around you. And, you know, partly that's about augmented reality, but it's also other technologies around autonomous vehicles and automation. You know, there is going to be a need for these services to understand the digital from the digital world to understand the physical world in a way we haven't seen before. How are they going to do that? Through maps. And at the moment, you know, we may be talking about kind of 2D and 3D maps sitting on your smartphone, but that geo database, all the information that sits in there, which is essentially a description of what the real world looks like and how it operates, you know, ever so valuable. And I'm kind of surprised that Microsoft didn't see that. But I guess I mean, it's probably fair to say it wasn't a core focus area for them, but you know, this kind of treatment of maps on Windows in general is just is frankly very disappointing.
Yeah, I think they've dropped the ball. I think you hit the nail on the head when you pointed out it's not just consumers accessing maps, because yes, there are other mapping applications out there, including, you know, even versions of Google Maps for Windows 10 Mobile, for goodness sake, which work pretty darn well. Plus, you can access it via the web. But applications, you've hit the nail on the head. Application, third-party apps, developers use the mapping APIs, which access the underlying licensed data, in this case from here, in their applications. Surely application developers, I'd have thought by now, would have been getting rather upset. Someone at Microsoft has dropped the ball in a big way. I'm hoping my article prodded someone at least to go and check. But someone somewhere needs to get, you know, get off their backside and do something about this. Anyway, my prediction is that something will happen, even if Microsoft end up switching to a different map provider. And who knows, they might, what would happen if Microsoft then decided to license Google's data and use Google's APIs, but within their own UWP apps? And, you know, like, who knows?
Can't see Google agreeing that, but yes, you never know.
Anyway, so that's a rather doom and gloom story and a rather frustrating way to end the podcast, but I think we've talked to some jolly interesting topics. I'll say goodbye and I'll let Rafe do the traditional sign off.
Yes, thank you, Steve. Thank you, as ever, Steve, for keeping the content flowing on the site. And thank you to everyone listening to this podcast. We really appreciate that you do so, and we appreciate the feedback. But I'll also sign off and say goodbye from me, and please tune in next time.